Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And welcome and a pleasant afternoon in Southern California and in Phoenix, Arizona. I hope everybody's having a good time. I'm Rob Starr, along with my famous co-host, Mr. Chris Davies. Chris, welcome.
I'm having a good time, all right, Rob. Hey, thanks very much. And it is pleasant right here in Southern California as well.
That's good. That's good. Had a good week. Everybody's getting their shots. And hopefully, I'm still on a waiting list, but can't wait to get those things because I want to be around for a couple more shows. Hope that goes well. So far, I haven't heard anything really, really bad about them out here. Things are going well, they said.
Most people I've talked to are willing to get the jab, you know, the vaccine, the inoculation, and, you know, several other terms you can add for it.
Yeah. The inoculation sounds formal. Just by the word, the sound of that. You know, welcome to the inoculation.
Inoculation center.
It sounds like it's from a rock opera.
Yeah, they're supposed to go in the arm. I saw a sign up here that says COVID vaccines in the rear.
Yeah. Well, that's the familiar voice I heard laughing in the background. That must be the wonderful purveyor of David's notebook, this Chris Austin.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
We've been fine.
And I'll just mention, since you're talking about vaccines, my husband has got both his vaccines. And, you know, he's been fine, other than, you know, the sore arm that you sometimes get from a vaccination. Yep. That's been it. He's doing well, and I'm waiting for my opportunity.
So nothing affected him after the second inoculation?
Nope.
Great. Well, that's good to know. Hey,
yeah,
so let's get right into
it. You hear the outliers. People need to remember the vast, vast majority of people have no side effects,
other than
a sore arm.
Yeah. And I had that when I got my flu shot. So I hear we're going to have an invasion of 1.1 million fishies coming to Central Valley.
Oh, invasion? No way. Can't call it that. Hatcheries are going to be releasing baby fish into the waterway. So what's better, what's more cheery than baby fish, right?
They're a year old, aren't they? I mean, I think that's they released them at 1 year, I think. 1 year
yeah.
old.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about steelhead is that, you know, salmon are released from hatcheries, and they mature in the rivers, and they swim out to the ocean, and they're out in the ocean for 2 to 3 years, generally 3 years, and then they come back, and they spawn in the river, and they die. But steelhead, unlike salmon, can go out to the ocean and come back and spawn in the rivers multiple times. They don't die after spawning. So that's sort of the interesting thing. So
I certainly know which checkbox I'd check if I was on an application.
So there's no baby, you know, babe, new baby fish in the rivers, or, you know, will be coming to the Central Coast. I think they said McCallamy and the Feather River and other ones. So Central Valley. So that's good. And here's an interesting little fact. I don't know if you know this, Chris. I know you're a fisherman, but the hatchery-born fish, they actually remove one of the fins so you know that it's a hatchery fish. So if you would catch a steelhead and it didn't have its adipose fin, then it came from a hatchery.
Does that mean you can only turn right or left?
Yeah. They're NASCAR fish. Only make left turns.
Yeah.
Well, you know, another fun fishing fact for Southern California, you know, is that apparently you can fish for stripers out of the California Aqueduct. And apparently there's some pretty big stripers you can catch in like Palmdale, which has, you know, no river with no fish, but it has the aqueduct. And they even have fishing sites where they built shade structures for the fishermen to fish out of the aqueduct. Have you ever fished out of the aqueduct, Chris?
Yeah, I have. Yes, up by Pear Valley, we did that a while back, several years ago, but there's only so many access points that you can get, right? Most of the California aqueduct is fenced off with high fences and, you know, razor wire. You can't get to it. There's no access except for those access points provided by, I think it's the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, you know, in the Central Valley, it's interesting there, you know, you will go to where the aqueduct crosses the, you know, highway or whatever, and they do have fencing that, you know, so that you can't drive your vehicle alongside the aqueduct, but there is usually a way a person with a fishing pole can go through there. And they tell you don't jump in the aqueduct, but, I mean, fishing out of the aqueduct, they know it happens because there's fish in there, which is just the funniest thing. You know, here in Southern California, where, you know, we've channelized our rivers and we've diverted all sorts of things, you know, we fish out of cement rivers, essentially. So it's kind of humorous to me.
I know during storms that we have in the early winter, they fish a lot of people out of the aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you don't want to be in there. Just kind of like the North Coast, you know. I mean, yeah. North Coast is one of the most beautiful areas in California, but the waves this time of year, you get these sneaker waves that just suck people out, and, you know, I mean, I hate reading the stories. So if you're going to go out by the ocean this time of year, especially when it's very wave, you know, a lot of waves, you want to be really careful, that's for sure.
You know, years ago, do you guys remember somebody called Ron Popeil?
Yeah.
Okay. And just think of 15, 20 years ago, if we invested in this company, Ronco, with all the what do they call it, the pocket fisherman things he used to sell, we'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, he did a bunch of that stuff. He was pretty good. Hey, Chris, let me know. So one more thing. Do you steelhead other than trout? I mean, I've seen some big trout, but steelhead can actually get bigger than trout, right? I mean, they get, you know, 7, 8, 10 pounds even.
Yeah, yeah, they sure can. Not as big as a sturgeon, but, you know, but yeah, you can pull some pretty hefty steelhead out. So, yeah, I mean, this is it's a good thing.
Well, I fished for steelhead in Idaho, right? Up there, Stanley, Idaho, and up in the Wasatch Mountains. The thing about them up there is I don't think those are ocean-going steelhead. I think because some species of steelhead just spend their entire lives in the rivers and streams. They don't ever go to the sea, and I think that's the species that are up in Idaho.
Well, you know, maybe that's so, and I'm not going to say that I really know the species in Idaho, but I will tell you that steelhead are actually really an incredible fish. They actually, if they have the opportunity and it's not blocked by dams, they go up much higher in the watershed than salmon do to spawn. They spawn in alpine streams beyond what the salmon do. I mean, in a sense, they are an amazingly strong animal, if you will, because they literally climb mountains. And if you have, I mean, I lived in Sacramento for years, and I'm not sure I ever went out to the river in the fall, but once I was up there in the fall, and I went out there, and there are salmon that are working their way up the river. Now, salmon, when they're getting ready to spawn, they're sort of at, like, the end, towards the end of their lifespan, but they are flinging themselves uphill. I mean, they're going up a river, right? So there's a lot of strength, and steelhead go even higher in the watershed. And I actually do believe that the rivers in Idaho, and they're talking about removing the dams and stuff, I'm not sure on my geography, but I do suspect that some of those actually do have an ocean connection.
Yeah.
And not surprising that salmon and steelhead would actually go up that far. I mean, it's amazing to think about, but steelhead do it, you know. So fish are an amazing species.
Right. Well, talking about streams that go, you know, way up in the mountains, there's another in your on this week, right, in the digest about State Water Control Board. The caption says, California's climate change future is being written in its waterways. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, the State Water Board is really been undergoing some processes. One of them is looking at how they handled things in the last drought and what they could do to be better. And then the second one is, how is climate change impacting water rights, and what are we going to do about it? And, you know, there was a story a week or two ago that talked about how our precipitation season is changing. It's, you know, starting later and it's cutting off sooner. And there are a lot of people, a lot of diverters, people with water rights, that those water rights specify an amount and a time and a season of diversion, right? So if your water right says that you can divert X amount of water starting at April 15th, say, which the snowpack used to last, you know, well beyond that, so there would be water there. But if there's less snow and it's melting sooner, April 15th may come and there may be no water there for you to divert. It's really going to mean a major adjustment. And I mean, to be honest, I think the State Water Board is a little bit behind the ball on this. This report that they put out is they're essentially saying, what can we do for any water rights applications that we get going forward? Okay, but that's not addressing the 40,000 plus people that already have water rights. And they're going to see situations changing on when they can take that water, because, you know, if your water right license says that you can start diverting water at, you know, April 15th and there's no water there and there isn't going to be any water there, then, you know, it's a problem. So there's just so many things that are changing with the way the water supply for the state is coming in. You know, the snowpack is getting lighter. We're getting more rain, less snow, and this is really affecting things. And, you know, it's great that the Water Board is looking forward and saying, you know, what should we do with water rights applications going forward? But at the same time, they're not really addressing what they're going to do about the, you know, 40,000 plus water rights that they already have.
Yeah, and it's not consumers, it's farmers as well, Chris. I mean, you know, they've got to be concerned, right? I mean, this is their bread and water, and it even trickles down to the consumer anyway, because if they've got to pay a lot for water to grow crops and fruits and vegetables and nuts and all that kind of stuff, that only makes those more expensive in the checkout line.
Absolutely. And, you know, climate change, you can debate the cause or whatever, but, you know, it's here and it's happening and it's affecting the way our water system is set up, because we're really set up for this idea that it snows a lot in the wintertime. We have this great snowpack. that melts off, and you have snow melt that runs, you know, through July. Many years ago, my husband and I used to travel to Lake Tahoe, and we would always try and take a hike, and we would be hiking past snow sometimes in the upper elevations. It wasn't uncommon. And that's the way our water system and infrastructure is set up. But if the snow isn't there, because if the snow has, you know, if we don't have a lot of snow and it has, and, you know, by May 1st, it's melted off, then it's really becomes a problem because, and this is why we need to sort of restructure our water system for the conditions that we're seeing. You know, this year, right now, there's a decent amount of snowpack up there. And if we get some more storms, we're probably going to be okay. But the question is, are we going to get more storms? And we're about ready to, you know, the last storms, I think, came through last week. And ever since then, it's been nice weather, I believe, up in the north as well as here in Southern California. And if that continues, while we'll all enjoy the mild weather, it doesn't bode well for water supply. So last year wasn't a great water year in terms of what we got, and this year's not looking much better. So
do you think this is going to spur California to spend more money on you know, storage, upgrading the infrastructure, even above ground stuff, right? I mean, keep in mind, as a long-term California resident, right, and having spent many, many years kind of wondering, when is the state of California going to invest in more water infrastructure, right? I mean, I've paid taxes for years and years and years, millions, billions of dollars. I don't know how much has been in the state. You know, but the state board's not built any infrastructure. They've done recycling stuff, and hey, we've done urban stormwater this and that, but not much infrastructure.
Well, in terms of water storage, in Prop 1, which I think the voters passed in 2014, that allocated $3 billion for water storage. And there are, you know, some good water storage projects going on here in the state. But, you know, first, there's two things I want to say before I launch into this. The first thing is that, you know, there's a reason why there haven't been a lot of dams built since the 1920s or the 1930s. And that is because from a geography, topological sort of point of view, the good spots have already been taken.
Yeah.
Our grandparents saw those opportunities and they took them. And geographically wise, there's not a lot of really great places to build reservoirs anymore. And the second thing is that even if you saw a good place to put a reservoir, if there isn't water that's going to come and fill it, there's not much point in building it. And it's not a matter of you build a dam there and the water will just appear. There's a hydrology and there's, you know, science behind that that figures that out. So, no, you are correct in that, you know, we haven't built a lot of water storage in the last 5 or 6 decades, but part of that is because there isn't any, you know, there aren't a lot of feasible spots. However, I should say that the Metropolitan Water District here built Diamond Valley Lake, which was it's a reservoir sort of in Riverside County, and they actually had to build, I think, 3 or 4 dams in this valley to make the space. So it wasn't like we're just going to, you know, build one dam here across this river. They actually built a bunch of what they call saddle dams to house the reservoir. And that reservoir doesn't have any natural input. it has the water that Metropolitan puts into it. However, they built that so that Southern California would have 6 months of water supply in the event of an earthquake, because one of the things they realized after the big drought in the 1990s was that we needed to have water storage south of the Tehachapis, you know, on the other side of all the earthquake faults. And the other thing that happened is up in Contra Costa County, the Contra Costa County Water District built a dam called Los Vaqueros Reservoir. And, you know, this water district, they're pretty plucky. They're smart. They don't wait for federal funding, because that takes literally decades to arrive, if ever. They actually went out, made the case to their constituents, and they built the reservoir, and they went back and they raised it, to store more. And now they're working to try and do a final raise to, you know, store even more water. And, you know, they've managed this because they made the case for the storage, and they have made the case to their constituents, and they've worked with the people that object to it. Again, Los Vaqueros Reservoir in Contra Costa County, it's not across a river. It's not blocking any access. It's kind of like Diamond Valley Lake. What is what they call off-stream reservoir storage, and they sort of built in the place where they can store this water. The least controversial projects for water storage are those that are what we call off-stream. You're not blocking a river to make the dam. And one of the projects that's happening now in Northern California is called Sites Reservoir. And it is an off-stream reservoir on the Sacramento River. They have a plan to pump water up to it and out of it. And they have great community support. They have people and organizations. You know, I believe Metropolitan's even bought into a share for this reservoir. So they have a lot of public participation and support, and they have a lot of money, people putting up money for this. So, you know, there are water storage projects happening across California, but, you know, there are certain things that make them successful.
Well, that is very true. Well, you know, Chris, we're going to come up against our commercials, but next time you're on, I want to follow up on a story that you did about produced water.
Oh, yeah, we got to talk about that.
And I think that's a great topic, and I really want to get into that. So maybe next week we could do that. But anyway, for those who are listening and want to hear more from Ms. Chris Austin, please go to maidensnotebook.com, become a subscriber, become a sponsor. It's the greatest source of water news in California and across the country. She does a whole bunch of stuff, and we rely on her to get all our water news, and she's the best person that we know. So, Chris, they go to www.maidensnotebook.com, and we'll talk to you next week, and I want you to be safe, and hope you get your shot coming up quick, and stay healthy.
Absolutely. You all, too. Good evening, everybody.
Take care.
All right, we'll be back in just a sec. We're going to be on to our little commercials, and then we'll be back for the show with our featured guest. So stand by.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toros water-efficient precision nozzles, SiteOne Landscape has 477 locations nationwide, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States and also have a growing presence in Canada. With over 30 locations here in Southern California, SiteOne's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, SiteOne has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control, landscape accessories, hardscape, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you and stop by today or contact our customer service center at 1-800-395-4477. Remember, if SiteOne Landscape Supply doesn't have it, no one has.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. Hope everybody's having a great evening tonight. We have a featured guest here. His name is Scott Bowen. He's director of water management. Let me give you a little background on this guy. I'm enamored by the connections he has, because I like sports. Scott has spent 25 plus years in the golf and professional sports industry. He's worked with Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer in golf construction and maintenance. In the professional sports industry, Scott's worked alongside multiple major league clubs, including, check this out, Texas Rangers, Kansas City Royals, Chicago White Sox, Los Angeles Dodgers. He's worked with various school districts and spent 9.5 years with the city supplies parks department, which is out here in Arizona. Along with turf and irrigation management, Scott has worked with numerous design consultants, landscape architects who follow passion for water management and conservation. And in the past 10 years, Scott has saved many communities water by training the staff on the proper way to irrigate and maintain the turf. He's a proud leader of the best irrigation technicians in the business. He's also a certified sustainable landscape management and certified golf irrigation auditor. And we want to welcome this guy because I want to talk sports more about and water. So, Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So, tell us how you got into doing what you're doing. What made you, growing up, you know, thinking maybe you're going to be a policeman, a fireman, like all of us do when we're little, cowboy, whatever, and you chose what you do. Why did you do that? How did you get that passion for that?
The irrigation side came as kind of an accident. I wanted to design golf courses, so I was going to school for landscape architecture and decided that I was going to pursue it full time. So I stayed in college and started working with a local company. There was a company, golf architects out of Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, Herds and Fry. And I talked to those guys and they said, you know, they're looking for guys with a degree in civil engineering and then a master's or another degree in landscape architecture. Plus they wanted at least a year of field experience. So I started looking for a local company to jump on. I locked into a irrigation golf company and loved it and stuck it out from there. So I kind of fell into it and really enjoyed it, and then just kept pushing the envelope from that point on.
Wow. What's the most exciting project and people that you work for over the years?
There's been a few. I think the most interesting ones that I worked on were back in the Ohio area. Worked on a couple of golf projects with the Nicholas Group. The company I worked for was called Irrigation Systems, Inc. They were a local company, and the landscape architect there that was doing a lot of work with these guys kind of, you know, led me into it. And we did probably 4 or 5 local ones that really caught my attention. And the Golf Club of Dublin was one that we did that kind of pushed me over the edge, that made me decide that I wanted to stay in the industry of golf and maybe look into sports fields as well. So New Albany Country Club was one that we did that was local. I worked on the Grizzly in Cincinnati. Bunch of different ones. So it was, but I would say those are the most interesting ones for me, because my dad's a huge Jack Nicklaus fan, so it was always cool to be able to say I was boots on ground on one of his courses that he designed or was working on in general.
Wow. So on the baseball side, you know, people don't realize, you know, that they go to a thing and they go to a game and they just say, well, it's the players that make the whole thing. But it's also the way the field is managed and kept. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the staff don't get credit like they should. These professional teams are extremely picky. I mean, playability of how the ball moves, how the ball spins once it hits the skin area, how it plays off the outfield grass, you know, mow height, thickness of turf, type of turf. So there's a lot of science that goes into it. I mean, I think in the turf world, the golf course superintendent, you know, he kind of wears the crown, but the baseball guys are, and the football guys, soccer guys, they're all right there with them. There's no difference. I mean, I've known a few that's bounced back and forth between the two. You know, these guys are impressive. They're a different breed, and I always was partial to golf because that's where my background was. That's what I came from. But once I started working with the Kansas City Royals and the Texas Rangers at the Surprise Spring Training Facility, it changed me completely, because when you add dirt to a plain surface and you have to maintain that clayed area just like you would the turf in the outfield or the turf in the infield, it changes the game, because you're switching surfaces literally as the ball plays. So it's a pretty impressive – they're a pretty impressive group of guys.
Wow. I know in Orange County, California, where the Angels play, I know that during their season and the rest of the year, they have motorsports, you know, motorcycle races, all concerts and things. And they even, I think they use West Coast turf to replace their turf. But they do it like 3-4 times a year. And that's got to be hard to deal with, you know, tearing up turf that you've got for a couple months, and now you're going to have pour a bunch of dirt on top of it to do motorcycle cross races and things of that sort, and then tear all that out and put new grass in again. I mean, it's got to be unbelievable, the science and the manpower it takes to do that, because they want those fields in primo condition, like you said. You know, they want to know where the ball's, how the ball's going to bounce, but also it's the players, you know, what they run on and things of that, you know, and there's a big difference between real turf and artificial turf. And I'm sure, and I know for a fact, that artificial turf also gets irrigated for several reasons. One, to clean it, two, to keep it cool. But what are some of those problems that you've seen over the years with fields that have to be changed a lot?
You know, it's just consistency with maintenance. You know, these guys, you know, you're putting down new sod each time. You're rebuilding the field. You know, they're taking the stuff off and putting it back on. It's not like these guys are getting back out on it immediately. So there are some times that, now I'm not saying that doesn't happen, because football games can, I mean, we've been in situations before I've seen, you know, sod went down. NFL does it for games where they've had a college game the day before, pulled up a bunch of stuff, put it right back down, and tried to play on it again. So it's one of those things that you just, like I said, it comes down to knowing your field, knowing the product that you're putting down, and being comfortable with your staff to make sure that happens. You know, the professional level, these guys, that's millions of dollars running around on those fields. So if someone steps in a hole for a sprinkler head or and a lip on a baseball field around the arc where the infield mix touches the turf, I mean, that's an eye socket. You know, that's a sprained ankle. That's a broken ankle. That's a torn ACL. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into whether it's natural turf or artificial. I mean, artificial is a very popular thing popping up. I mean, it's been around for quite a while, but it's starting to gain some ground here, and I think in the last 5 years. So, you know, like, and then that also comes down to who puts it in, you know, what material are you using? So it comes down to materials and staff, I think 100%.
Do you think the artificial turf versus real turf has to do more with water conservation or playability and maintainability?
I think it depends on who you ask. I would say it's a mixture. Playability, you know, so we're on a project right now. We're wrapping up a project that we're doing with Hellas Construction in the Phoenix area. So Phoenix Unified Schools are redoing all of their football fields from natural grass to synthetic. And, you know, it comes down to a maintenance piece with that as well. I mean, if you don't have the staff that understands and has the know-how to really protect these kids, then using the synthetic is the way to go. You know, using turf that way is a lot safer. You know, it's more cost-effective because you don't have to paint every week. You don't have to water it as much, but in Phoenix, I mean, we're putting some big cannons out. We're using the Toro, the 120s on the Phoenix schools, and we'll probably bounce around using some 170s and stuff like that as well. But you got to keep these fields wet. I mean, when it's 120 out, it's a problem. I mean, that stuff will melt you per se, not necessarily the grass, but you fall on that stuff when it's hot and it's not properly irrigated or properly moisturized. It's a problem.
Wow. So. In all your career on sportsmen, what do you think is the toughest to manage? Is it the greens on a golf course? Is it the infield or the outfield of a baseball or soccer? What do you think is the most difficult?
I think it depends on the region. Just for example, I was an assistant superintendent at Riviera Country Club in Dublin, Ohio, and my boss, the time the superintendent there, always told me never go west, never go south, never go from private to public if you're a superintendent. So, and it all comes down to the dollars. You know what I mean? If you have the money to maintain perfect greens, maintain perfect fairways, tee boxes, stuff like that, then you can accomplish it. For me, I think it was tougher growing grass out here in the West, in my opinion, just because of the heat and because of the soils. The salt in the Arizona soils is ridiculous. So I think it's a little bit tougher to maintain what some people would call that perfect playability. On the flip side with sports fields, you know, now you have a lot of foot traffic with longer turf, but you're also mixing in infield mix as well. So I think it just depends on the sport. It's more of a, for me, it's, I think they're all difficult in their own way, and I think each one is easy in their own way. So that's a hard question to answer, just because I've been fortunate enough to work in both, and I've had my struggles in one, and I've had my struggles in the other, and I've had, you know, great opportunities in one like I have in the other. So I would say most difficult, I think, is just the heat. For me at this point in my career.
I know when I go to baseball games, usually about the fifth inning, you see a crew go out, you know, rake the infield. And most people who are fans just watch that and they think, oh, that's pretty easy. They mow it before they show up and do this. So it doesn't look like it's really hard, but it is hard work. And it's really important how that field stands up and how it acts to the people who are playing on it to make sure that it's going to give them the best play that they can and a safe way to go. So I wish they would promote more of what people like you do and give you guys a lot more credit, because I know for the golf side, just before a major is being played somewhere, and they spend weeks getting this thing in primo condition. I mean, it's got to be down. It's down to the science. The temperature of the green's got to be this. The blades can only be this much high and so forth and so on. I give people like you a whole lot of credit, because it's not just mowing and blowing and hard labor doing it. There's a lot of stuff that goes into this that you have to know the science of it. So I commend all the stuff that you guys do. Chris, any comments and questions?
Yeah, so what you said, Rob, I mean, all the stuff that you just said and all the hard work that goes into it, those are only things that we see on the surface, right? That's what the players see, and that's what the people who go to the games and see. They see everything on the surface. There's a ton of stuff that needs to be maintained, carefully washed, installed correctly, and all that stuff that we don't see, and that's the stuff underground. So, hey, Scott, first of all, welcome to the show. I've got the download on you from Brian Witcher, and we'll talk about that when Brian's not around.
For sure.
But, hey, so can you talk just a little bit about what people don't see, about what is under the ground and how important it is, the stuff that's under the ground, how important that is to what people do see on the surface?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said before, everything that goes into growing grass, especially in the Southwest and the desert, the right chemicals, the right soil structure, the right turf grass, the right amount of water, it all comes into play. If you don't have everything dialed in, it becomes an issue. I mean, you have to put down a certain amount of water on an infield skin before a game.
Right.
Just for example, with us in Surprise, we would water the skin probably right before the national anthem, and we'd load it decent. But if it's a cool night and you put too much water on it, you're going to have puddles coming up in about the seventh inning. So there's definitely a rhyme or reason for stuff they do. These guys aren't just going out there and just sprinkling water around saying, hey, it just looks fun to darken up the dirt a little bit. It's not about that. And that's why you see the seventh inning drags and the third inning drags, because these guys are, they're stepping in stuff. There's a lot that goes into the field. The Turfus product that everybody's using now, that's a covering. I mean, it's basically a field conditioner that covers the divot. So if you don't take care of that and maintain that each and every time you go out and spike the skin or drag that thing out, or when you see the guys come out in between those innings and all run around and they're pulling those drags, this is kind of off the subject, but those guys would be more than willing to give any fan in the stands that drag and let them run around that field with it, because those things are not light. So there's like I said, there's rhyme or reason for everything that they do. The stuff that you don't see, a lot of these fields are sand based. So the
percolation, yeah,
completely,
yeah,
different.
There's a lot that goes into a typical day for you, right? I mean, not just as I said before, not just what the fans see during the game or right pregame. So kind of like, what's a typical day for you? This is back when you were working with, not in golf, but out with the sports teams, the Rangers and the Royals and White Sox and stuff like that. What would a typical day start with?
So we were at Surprise, we had seniors, which is basically like a foreman. So the foreman would come in 6 o'clock. They'd start prepping the fields, getting things ready, watering skins down for the teams to come out. The biggest thing that people don't really understand is that these MLB teams, they don't leave. Everybody thinks that they come in for pitchers and catchers in mid-February, like they're getting ready to do right now. They run through March, and they're gone. They take off. Well, the MLB guys take off. You still have 200 players that are in that organization that haven't landed on a team yet that don't stop. So there's extended spring. There's fall ball. There's summer ball. It's nonstop. And then, at a place like Surprise,
Peoria is kind of the same way with the Padres and the Mariners and some of the other ones. They're owned by the city, so they're stuffing recreation in there as well. So, you know, we come in at 6 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes we don't get done till. I mean, if there's something going on that next morning early, we stay until it's done. It's not; these aren't typical city jobs where these guys are, you know, 9-to-5ers. It's a tough job. It's tough on family. You know, it's not just a come in, do your job, and go home.
Yeah, sure. So over the years, with all the upgrades and all the changes, everything that we've seen on, you know, not just practices on the field and how you do things, but also in products and in the technology and all that kind of stuff, kind of share with us, if you can, you know, what's some of the biggest changes or improvements you've seen over the years, Scott?
So for me, I've been fortunate starting in golf. So we're always aware of ET. So running irrigation and playing that game with ET is always been something that we're aware of. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a sports turf guy or an ET guy that says they'll water, or a golf guy or a sports turf guy that says they'll water on ET. We're definitely aware of it, but we're not going to, I mean, our turf has to be next level. So, as you guys know, with the whole ET side of things, it's not, you're not getting the best of the best if you water with those numbers. So, it's good to be aware and be able to manage the irrigation piece that way. I think some of the stuff that I've seen that's become a lot better than what it used to is the soil moisture aspect of sport and of golf. I've been out of the golf industry for a little bit, I left the golf industry in 2007 to go to the sports turf side. So I don't know how much, I'm assuming that the golf is using soil moisture quite a bit, because we're using it in the baseball and football and soccer side of things as well. So, but that's been the biggest leap for me, is being able to control your soil profile with devices to make things a little bit easier. Now, I'm not saying that we're giving full control to it, but it's definitely making it a lot easier to deal with things if we're aware of what's going on in the surfaces that we can't see.
Yeah, soil moisture sensing is a big deal, Scott, for sure, right? Not just in the golf industry, but also in sports fields and grounds, and in ag, and, you know, just about every aspect. And there's a lot of a lot of companies right now working really hard to bring better technology to the industry, not just for soil moisture sensing, but, you know, flow metering is another big deal. There's a lot of neat stuff going on in the industry right now that I think is exciting for the, you know, the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to follow up that with a question. So we've talked about, you know, irrigation and water conservation and all that stuff, but, you know, topside, I was just going to ask a question when I was asking a little earlier about turf care, right? So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of equipment that is that's involved in maintenance of a sports field or a complex, whether it's baseball, soccer, football, hockey, whatever. Are you also familiar, Scott, or you work closely with the what we call the red iron equipment that takes care of the field as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we had in Surprise was majority Toro. So we used that wasn't part of my gig, so all the numbers following it. But we'd use fairway mowers, you know, the Triplex, the TR3s, that type of mower as well. So everything was real mowed on a majority of these sports fields.
What do you think of the technology today that is able to service or, you know, wash down, clean, irrigate synthetic fields, sports fields, football fields, especially soccer fields, without any on-field spray heads, right? Nothing is on the spraying surface anymore. All of these big heads that you were talking about earlier, the 120-foot and 170-foot heads, they're not on the field. They're all around the perimeter. So there's no, you know, there's no sprinkler head, there's no cup or anything on the field to get in the way of player safety. Do you see that as a trend?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I think it depends on the companies and what they're trying to do. We're going to be working on some stuff here coming up in the next couple months, I would say, on different ways to manage the synthetic a little bit better, to start measuring the water in the profiles and stuff like that. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail. These guys will have my behind for it, but you're going to start seeing some different technologies used in this type of industry as well. These big heads are a game changer, you know, and they've been around for a long time, but, yeah, you know, being able to use the valve and head style, like, you know, the golf head that's throwing 170 feet. I mean, that's, you can't get any better than that. And there's ways to hide them now that we're doing. We're messing with some different ways to cover it up so you can't even see it. If you guys ever want to go out and check out some of the ones that we've done in Phoenix, we'd be more than happy to have you out and take a closer look at them. But, yeah, it's definitely changing the game. You have to be careful. I mean, you know, these kids are getting recruited as freshmen in high school, sometimes earlier. So the injuries can't happen. And being able to protect the student athletes and from, you know, high school to college to whatever, it's very, very important.
I'd love to come out there, Scott, for sure. Right now it's a little difficult to do under the current circumstances, as Rob was saying.
But. Hey, I had a text that came into me. It's a kind of a funny question, but they wanted to know, how come some baseball fields on the outfield, it looks like they mow them with stripes? And does that do anything, or is that just for look? Basically, I think, don't they just mow them in the opposite direction to get the stripes? But is there a reason they do that? That's the question.
No, it depends. I mean, in surprise, we would mow certain patterns into it. It's for aesthetics. I mean, it looks good. You know, when you put ryegrass that's cut in that way. Bermuda doesn't stripe all that well. But ryegrass, yeah, it's absolutely, it's definitely for aesthetics. It doesn't change the way the ball plays or anything like that. I mean, these fields are mowed so often to burn those stripes in. It's you know, they're pretty equal across the field. So, but yeah, it's more for aesthetics than anything else, I would say.
Yeah, it's not like a putting green where the blades, you know, the guy gets down and looks to see which way the blades are turning, so which way he puts the ball. It's not going to matter in baseball, right?
No, not so much. No, definitely rolling a golf ball across the green with the sun, with mo. Yeah, I've seen some issues with that before in some tournaments where I've not been real happy with the cut. So, yeah, it's much, much different. You know, I mean, you're mowing at, you know, three-quarters of an inch probably on average with these guys, maybe a little bit lower, depends on the complex or the field. But they're mowing pretty low nowadays on these ball fields, baseball fields, especially on the MLB side of things. But like I said, it's just a whole different monster between those two sports for sure.
So if there's people out there who think you've got a cool job, which I think you have a great job, how do people? What would your advice be? What should they do first?
I would say get in the field. I remember, it's going to sound bad for me, but I used to argue with my college professor when I was doing landscape architecture about irrigation, because I was in the field putting it in. I knew what worked and what wouldn't work. Just because it's put on a 2D drawing doesn't mean it's always going to happen that way in the field. So I think, and that was the advice I got from Michael Herdson, was, hey, go get in the field. Go figure it out. You know, put pipe in the ground, get dirty, get sweaty, get messy. And you'll learn the little things, that the little nuances that happen that you can't predict on paper. These guys designing it are fantastic. I've worked for some really good ones. I worked for Steve Sisler for a while. Steve is a irrigation consultant in the Phoenix area, and his hydraulic knowledge was
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
NBC News.